Good morning, Chicago. I'm Araceli Gomez-Saldana, in for Sasha and Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, and we have a lot of news to cover for you. Time to catch up on what's been happening lately across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap. We're going to take you behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
Aggressive federal immigration enforcement tactics deployed in a Chicago neighborhood.
They may have violated the TRO that was issued against ICE.
13 Chicago police officers were also affected by the tear gas.
The fencing around the ICE processing facility, well, it has now been removed.
Naval Station Great Lakes in North Chicago have been informed that federal immigration agents will continue to use the base.
We're going to condemn political violence in all forms, whether it comes from a gunman or masked ICE agents.
Lots to dive into, and I can't do it alone. So here to dive deep into these stories and much more is Jacoby Cochran, host of CityCast Chicago, the daily podcast and newsletter. Good morning, Jacoby.
It's good to see you, my friend.
Nice to see you. Also with us is Alex Nitkin, government, finance, and accountability reporter with the Illinois Answers Project at the Better Government Association. Hi, Alex.
Good morning.
Good
it's so
morning.
Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. And Chicago Sun-Times reporter Violet Miller. Welcome to the recap, Violet.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right, let's dig in. So this week, a high-speed car chase involving federal agents resulted in chaos in a Southeast Side neighborhood. Alex, do you want to help us make sense of what happened? That happened on Tuesday. It seems like so long ago.
Right. It seems like every day we're getting another one of these just outrageous and disturbing videos where it's really hard to tell exactly what is happening. But I mean, essentially, what we know is that there was a crash, two people were arrested. There is the sort of DHS and ICE narrative, which, as has happened in a lot of cases, was very quickly, I don't know when to say totally disproven, but made
Question
very hard
sure.
to square with not only the direct experiences of the people who were there and talking to folks, but also like actual video cameras. So to back up a little bit, basically a unmarked ICE SUV was seen on security cameras, on security footage, crashing and sort of ramming into someone else's SUV, dragging it down a block. A person got out of the car. They ran away. ICE chased them down and detained them. Of course, the DHS statement is that the other car rammed the ICE car. We don't really have any reason to believe that, frankly. And then the, you know, what happened is often what happens with these incidents, which is that a crowd gathered and people were sort of like chanting and jeering at these masked, you know, federal agents. And then they just started throwing chemical agents, tear gas, and they arrested two more people.
Yeah, a lot of people affected. Police officers, elderly people were affected by this tear gas that we saw on video. So yeah, very, very interesting. And we also saw, I mean, we don't know if the car did ram into federal agents because there's no security footage of that as of yet that we've found. But we know that the federal agents used a maneuver that is banned by some police departments, and that's the crashing into a car to stop them. What, you know, did we see this before?
I mean, we are seeing new things every day essentially being done by these federal agents. It's very clear that they are just don't feel like they are bounded by any of these sort of, you know, typical regulations that we see around police. We've seen them ram into cars either trying to, like, as they're getting out of places or just really reckless tactics. The East Side incident was yet another incident of them throwing tear gas without offering warnings first, just as sort of like, you know, I just want to get out of here. Let me just like pop some canisters of tear gas out of my window, almost as sort of like a very casual thing, as something that's supposed to be done as a last resort.
Yeah.
And continuing to cover their faces and not use body cameras, which are both things that have now been ordered by a federal judge. And so these are things that people are now, you know, starting to demand, and more reasons why you're seeing like people in these communities and the people who came out to respond to and protest this really not recognize them as like a legitimate law enforcement agency, but is this just sort of like rogue paramilitary force that's just doing whatever they want.
Yeah. Jacoby, what was your reaction to seeing all that happen on Tuesday?
As Alex pointed out, as Violet's coverage has shown, this is yet another neighborhood. Brighton Park has experienced this. Broadview is experiencing this. Neighbors in parts of Logan Square. Like, when these agents arrive to a neighborhood charged on 100, their goal is to do nothing else than to terrorize the neighborhood in some respects, to abduct and kidnap with, in some cases, out warrants without probable cause, to racially profile the people in that neighborhood. And so there is no shock that they're showing up in primarily black and brown neighborhoods. And the difficult part in all of these narratives is trying to both square the fact that this is wholly unique, but also in many ways, this is deja vu for Chicagoans. We've been beaten by agents of the state before and tear gassed and raided, right? We've had, like we've seen, cars sort of rammed in these chases, cops not use body cams, mask themselves, you know, cuss at us and put their hands on us. And so in many ways, what we're seeing is sort of the ICE show up as almost the final boss of state violence, because at least in some of those cases, we've seen faux attempts and some successful attempts to try and, you know, make officers wear body cameras, even though they sometimes turn them off, and to stop foot chase policies, which some has argued is very confusing. And yet Chicagoans really don't know who to turn to when a federal judge has already said some of these tactics are unconstitutional and illegal. But you know, they just kind of continue with free reign.
That's a good point. Like, where do people turn to, right? So we saw that Governor Pritzker saying that agents may have violated a restraining order by tear gassing the crowd after the crash. Violet, what have the court said about ICE and Border Patrol using chemical irritants like tear gas, pepper balls, smoke bombs, things like that?
Yeah, as was mentioned earlier, this temporary restraining order, from District Court Judge Sarah Ellis requires agents to give at least two verbal warnings before using these, chemical agents, pepper balls, rubber bullets, tear gas in these neighborhoods. And they're only supposed to be used for immediate threats. But however, like we said, they're using these seemingly in response to words in a lot of these cases. Again, DHS is claiming that, things were thrown. And in Tuesday's case, at least CPD, claimed to back that up in their statement. But there's so much chaos on the ground that it's hard to actually parse what's going on in some of these situations. But just yesterday, Judge Sarah Ellis, the same one that made the initial temporary restraining order, said to the government, "I'm not blind." So now after seeing Tuesday, after seeing Sunday in Albany Park, and to your point, one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the city, Judge Sarah Ellis is demanding federal agents, their leaders in court. She's trying to require body cameras for them. The details haven't been worked out on that, so that's not like something that's going to start tomorrow, but we will see that, build up as these things proceed. But, it really is at this point just seemingly these agents coming into these neighborhoods and agitating, like you said. I mean, a lot of these cases, the tear gas is getting thrown not just in multiple rounds, but also as they're exiting,
right.
As we saw in Brighton Park. Yep, exactly. As they were driving the wrong way down a one-way street where there weren't protesters, they threw flashbang grenades and tear gas canisters into the front yards of residents who had already been sheltering in their home out of fear of what had just happened down the street when federal agents shot a woman. Mm-hmm. It seems like there really is not going to be an end, despite these restraining orders, to any of this. So the question really remains, what is going to rein in these federal agents?
Yeah, I think we're all kind of like seeing the enforcement behind some of these orders. So moving from the southeast side to the southwest side, where yesterday more than a dozen people were detained at the flea market known as Swamparama. Jacoby, did you hear about what happened there just yesterday?
Yeah, I saw video from people who were on site. I've seen pictures in the aftermath. ICE agents pulling out assault weapons, storming the Swamparama. You know, the way they've gone about these raids, sort of posting up outside of Home Depot and schools and rushing into hospitals, it's always been clear that we live in a surveillance state, that ICE knows how to terrorize people, where to be. We know that the discount mall in La Villeta, which has already been downsized over the last few years, was going to be a site of raids. And it was. We knew eventually Swamparama would be a site as, You know, a ton of vendors are in there week after week. We've done an episode with those individuals. Some people primarily speak Spanish, and folks who come in who primarily speak English have learned to speak a little Spanish just to shop there because they know that this is where, you know, this community gathers. And, you know, I've seen a lot of criticism of the owner of the Swaparama, who promised vendors in many ways in recent months that they would go out of their way to protect them, that they wouldn't allow immigration to come in. And that was not the case. And so to see, again, people sort of just being swept up, this wide net being cast over people of varying legal status, it's clear what this campaign is truly about. And for those who doubt it, who would still watch and say, they shouldn't have been there, or they should have gone about this process differently. That's proven to be, you know, beyond cruel at this point and beyond sort of a fallacious argument.
And we've seen some local lawmakers trying to do some things about this, right? So barring ICE from public property, Evanston, Hammond, Indiana, my neck of the woods, Cook County, they've all followed Chicago by setting up these so-called ICE-free zones. And Violet, Cook County's top judge is banning immigration arrests at courthouses even. So that sentence there is even a little bit like, wow, that should have been happening. But what happens now?
Yeah. So specifically, the chief judge is banning civil arrests. Judicial arrest warrants can still be carried out on courthouse property. But just a few days ago, we saw folks who were detained outside Rolling Meadows Courthouse in the suburbs. The Cook County Public Defender's Office said they're aware of at least 9 folks who have been detained on court property by federal immigration agents on their way to court. So this, you know, could be witnesses. These could be parties to cases. And so what the chief judge says is essentially this is disrupting the legal process, the judicial system. And so that's why the order was put forth. But DHS told me earlier this week they will not be abiding by that order. They will continue to do exactly what they're doing, which is the same response we've seen in a lot of these cases. And so I think the question with these ICE-free zones is, what is enforcement going to look like? Because I know that I have not gotten a clear answer. Mayor Brandon Johnson has talked about, trying to prosecute for, you know, things like trespassing. But again, until we actually see this in practice, it's seemingly the only legal avenue that a lot of these local leaders have, because earlier with Mayor Brandon Johnson's executive order a few months ago that, you know, initially was touted as requiring federal agents to wear masks was just a suggestion, because, again, these local and state leaders do not have the legal jurisdiction to be making these decisions for federal agents. And so these ICE-free zones, and specifically, I think one of the biggest things is just reminding private property owners that they can refuse ICE from entering their property, from using it as a staging area, as we've seen in, especially in Brighton Park ahead of that shooting. You know, I spoke to the alderwoman there, and she said that in local parking lots, they've seen ICE and other federal agents staging. And so, again, there's still a lot of questions about what this, measure will actually amount to.
I mean, I think that that's really speaking to an interesting and important dynamic in this, which is that what they're being restrained by, these agents, is not necessarily laws or norms or what kinds of ordinances you pass. It is people. It is people coming together and forming these groups in their neighborhoods, pulling out their phones and trying to just like make it really difficult for them to actually do their jobs. That I think is really important and something that I think that people in other cities have really been drawing as a lesson from this.
Yeah, this is In the Loop. I'm Araceli Gomez-Aldana in for Sasha Ann Simons. We're breaking down the biggest stories of the week with a panel of local journalists, Violet Miller of the Chicago Sun-Times, Jacoby Cochran of CityCast Chicago, and Alex Nitkin with the Illinois Answers Project. He's an investigative reporter there. We've seen a lot of ICE incidents in the suburbs as well. So we've covered here Chicago, a lot of stuff going on in the suburbs. In Northwest Suburban Hoffman Estates, there were calls for a federal investigation after a video of a local teen being detained by ICE went viral. Alex, did you cover that?
This is yet another incident of we get one of these disturbing videos that makes ICE look really bad, and then us, you know, reporters and people who have covered this, like Violet, trying to go work backwards and figure out what actually happened. So essentially what we know is that an 18-year-old woman in Hoffman Estates was following ICE cars and honking her horn,
yeah.
Which is a tactic, you know, like I was just talking about, of trying to sort of warn people and really swarm agents and sort of bring the community out and protect people from these raids. And that led to what we saw on the video, which was four federal squad cars surrounding this teenager's car, going up to the door, prying her, dragging her out of the car,
yeah.
and sort of like spinning her around and tackling her to the ground and arresting her. We know now she's a U.S. citizen. She was born here. She was still detained a couple of hours. And I think to me, the most remarkable part of this was the statement that the Department of Homeland Security and ICE gave about this. They said, oh, this is a video of a burglary arrest in Chicago from a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we all looked at that and we're like, you know, we can literally see like Hoffman Estates police vehicles in there. Like, why are you... And, like, we know that this happened last week. Why would you just fabricate something like this, like, totally out of thin air? And I think that is just one more thing that has, you know, that even federal judges have recognized that,
yeah.
like, what we are hearing as both in legal arguments and in media from the federal government is just not passing muster with anyone who digs even a little bit further than that.
And another instance was the four cemetery workers and the suburban mayor standing up and saying, you know, this shouldn't have happened. They were accosted by ICE agents. They were hit with pepper spray, arrested and detained. These were U.S. citizens. Jacoby, that happened in Forest Park.
Yeah, there were cemetery workers who saw some individuals struggling in the Des Plaines River, trying to figure out if they needed help, to then find themselves sort of in the middle of one of these abduction attempts. And ICE, of course, then sort of turned their aggression towards the workers, like yeah. you said, hitting them with those chemical agents, the pepper balls, detaining them. It's very clear that they don't believe that any of us should be doing anything to hold them accountable. The narratives that they push, as Alex has pointed out, to consistently share stories that are so easily misproven would then make us think, oh, so we're just dealing with a bunch of incompetent people. And the answer can be yes, but incompetent people can carry out very cruel racist and white supremacist ideologies. Because let's be real, the ideology that much of these campaigns sit on are foolish within themselves, right? And are not backed by evidence. And so I don't want us to get distracted by the incoherency of their arguments in courts or by the president or others, because they don't care about sound, like having a sound, like reason or logic for what they're arguing. They simply want to sort of scare you into compliance. And it's clear that Chicagoans are not going.
Yeah. And you're right. We spent so much time and resources fact checking and reviewing statements and what happened. I keep thinking also what the officials at the Great Lakes Naval Base, they've been told that ICE will be stationed here through at least December. So this is still happening. Violet, how exactly are federal agents using this North Suburban Lakefront space? What have you been hearing about how long this is all going to last?
Yeah, so for my sources, in various places, we've been able to, you know, essentially obtain emails saying that ICE and other federal immigration agencies, DHS specifically, the kind of overarching branch, will be staying at Naval Station Great Lakes through at least December with the possibility of extension. They've been using this as a command center. They've got office space there. They're using it to park 140 of the vehicles that are being used in these operations. These are undercover vehicles. They're not marked. But in addition to that, in the initial request for space at the base, they requested 7,200 cubic feet of storage facilities for medical supplies and things like tear gas, pepper balls, weapons, all of these different things that we are seeing, you know, be used across the city. And to your earlier point about, you know, just citizens and different folks getting caught up in the middle of this when they step in, I mean, per some ProPublica reporting this morning, 170 U.S. citizens have been detained by federal immigration agents this year, which is 50 more than the entirety of the first Trump term.
Wow.
So, you know, obviously this is, you know, they're being more brash about who they're taking in, about who they're, just flat out arresting. And to another earlier point also, you know, these teens that are being arrested, underage folks, you know, they don't have underage detention facilities, a point that was brought up by one of my colleagues, Lauren Fitzpatrick, earlier this week. And we saw the lawyers for a 15-year-old, you know, detained during this Eastside incident Tuesday, said he was held in a vehicle in the parking garage of a federal facility. You know, DHS spokesperson Trisha McLaughlin has now said that it was in one of the FBI buildings downtown. And so, you know, it really seems that they are just using any federal property they can for whatever purpose they can. And that's from Naval Station Great Lakes to federal buildings downtown.
This is In the Loop. I'm Araceli Gomez-Saldana in for Sasha Ann Simons, and you're tuned in to the weekly news recap where we take you behind the headlines of the week's top local stories. Before the break, we took a deep dive into the immigration arrests and protests that have been happening, but there's a lot more news to get to.
This budget has been the one that we have been not just fighting for, but waiting for.
Mayor Brandon Johnson's budget does not include a property tax increase.
He's calling it Protecting Chicago as a clapback to social safety net cuts at the federal level.
State lawmakers head back to Springfield for the start of what's shaping up to be a jam-packed veto session.
I am very hopeful that a transit bill will, in fact, appear in the legislature in the veto session.
We don't want cuts to our transit agencies. We want trains to continue to run on time, buses to run on time.
Our panel today to help break down these stories, Violet Miller of the Chicago Sun-Times, Alex Nitkin of the Better Government Association, and Jacoby Cochran of City Cash Chicago. Let's turn to city politics. Mayor Johnson delivered his budget address yesterday. Alex, what are some of the strategies for bringing in more revenue?
That's a really good question, and that really was what we were looking for, especially since the main, you know, lever that city mayors pull to bring in more revenue, and we knew that he was going to need some to close this more than $1 billion budget gap, is usually a property tax. But the mayor has been promising to not touch property taxes.
He said he won't do it.
So we saw some, I'll say, creative and maybe unexpected ones that he turned to. I mean, the one that has probably gotten the most attention is what he is calling the community safety surcharge, what we are calling a head tax, which is basically a tax per employee per year on businesses. This would only be businesses of more than 100 employees. And this is a tax that had existed in the city of Chicago before former Mayor Rahm Emanuel got rid of it in 2011. He said that it was sort of like a, you know, anti-business, that it was driving businesses away. And so this is something that, you know, it was sort of surprising. We'd not thought that there was that much political will to bring it back. And who knows, maybe there isn't, depending on what happens with the city council. But the argument is the sort of theme around the mayor's budget proposal and budget address was like, we are going to big business and corporations, and they're going to start paying their fair share. I mean, the head tax community safety surcharge is part of it. That's expected to bring in $100 million. But even what has sort of flown under the radar, the biggest revenue increase would be on something called the personal property lease transaction tax, the PPLT, PPLTT, which is basically like a tax on rental services and software, including cloud computing. This has been, it's a transaction tax. It is something that mayors and the city leaders have gone back to the well on and raised, I think in part because it's very hard to explain what it is. And so it's very hard for people to be mad at, like, don't raise my personal property lease transaction taxes, you know? But, like, it is something that basically it's a tax on cloud computing and a lot of business services. Okay. So it's something that obviously businesses are really not happy about. And there's sort of, you know, we're seeing the Chamber of Commerce and Illinois Retail Merchants Association and all of the sort of big business groups come out and say, this is going to be a job killer. This is going to drive companies out of the city. And Johnson's counter is basically like, they can afford it. It's time for businesses to step up, especially because they've gotten big federal tax cuts. And I think it's sort of like, you know, essentially both things can be true. In a lot of cases, maybe they can afford it, but it is a real question of, will there be some companies that this will be a factor and, like, maybe they won't come to Chicago or it will be a tying factor for them. And the other big thing was just raiding $1 billion from the city's tax increment financing districts, which is sort of a one-time measure. But these are all local economic development districts that sort of pull property taxes for development. And this was just a giant sweep of that which is sort of not, it's more of a one-time fix. So a combination of sort of recurring and one-time things, but as always, the one-time things are less controversial and the recurring ones are going to be harder to see if they can actually pass muster politically.
I liked how you said interesting, creative. My ears perked up when I heard about the Chicago School Board. The budget, it seems that there's a strategy to send $500 million to school. Where is that money coming from?
I mean, originally it's coming from property taxpayers, which just sort of speaks to how controversial the TIF program is. Again, the TIFs are things, they're local districts that siphon property tax dollars away and put them into local accounts for economic development. And so every year we see the mayor declare a really big TIF surplus. And it's sort of like inconsistent, and a big part of what led up to a big part of the CPS funding crisis is like, you never know from year to year how big a surplus is going to declare. You know, it's sort of inconsistent and difficult to follow. But because our property taxes, more than half of them go to CPS. CPS is the biggest in the city of Chicago, that is. Most of our property taxes go to Chicago Public Schools, and about a quarter of our property taxes go to the actual city of Chicago. Whenever a TIF surplus is declared, you're taking all of that property tax money that had gone to these districts and you're sending them back essentially to the taxing bodies, the governments where they would have gone in the first place. And so naturally, the follow-on of that is that half of that money, of that $1 billion, goes to CPS and a quarter of that money goes to the city. And so to CPS, this is just sort of like manna from heaven. This is what they were hoping for. The question is, what is the strategy going forward? Because we're talking about real structural deficits that either you can find some other revenues for or cut spending, or let some of these TIF districts expire so that the money will just go to their natural taxing bodies in the first place.
Yeah. Jacoby, so we know Johnson is a former teacher, union lobbyist. Do you think anybody was surprised to see the education mayor finding some money for schools?
That's a really interesting question. And I feel like any time during his administration, people see public schools standing next to him in press conferences, receiving, finances, people will ask that question and make those connections. But I do think it's important to, one, realize that the last year of his relationship with Chicago Public Schools, particularly former Chicago Public School head Pedro Martinez, wasn't all roses. And there have been some sort of back and forth between him and the district that they've managed. But then on the other end, Chicago Public Schools have been woefully underfunded. We have talked ad nauseum about the state formula for education funding underserving and underfunding public schools. We've lived over the last decade in population decrease. We are coming off the heels a decade ago of 50 largely black and brown schools being closed. And so I think the story really should be, is this investment in Chicago Public Schools, to Alex's point, is it going to create the sort of long-term successes we want, the type of investment in neighborhood schools and in young people and in teachers that we want? I would hope that, every time, public schools sees some investment, it isn't a question of like, oh, is this just like political cronyism? We're trying to invest in schools at the end of the day.
Yeah. Definitely. This is In the Loop. I'm Araceli Gomez-Aldana in for Sasha Ann Simons. We're breaking down the biggest stories of the week with a panel of local journalists, Violet Miller of the Chicago Sun-Times, Jacoby Cochran of CityCast Chicago, and Alex Netkin with the Illinois Answers Project at the Better Government Association. So we know Illinois lawmakers back in Springfield are back in fall veto session, and they're dealing with big issues, including how to close a $230 million budget gap for Chicago area public transit. Now, that's better than the more than $700 million shortfall the RTA originally projected, but it's still a lot of money. Jacoby, where are we with this transit crisis?
That is a very good question. And I'm glad that you remind people that that is a lot of money.
Yes.
Because that's pretty much the exact same amount of money that just brought the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority to its knees.
Right.
And we saw loads of people across Philadelphia and the suburbs wake up one day wondering where their route is, and had to be subjected to fare hikes. Something that Chicagoans should probably prepare for next year, But where we are right now is lawmakers are back with the hope of passing at least one or two bills, one that would essentially reconfigure how RTA operates, give it a new name, give it some new powers, some new authority, and then another bill that would essentially fill these operational budget gaps. I know a lot of people are like, hold on, how are we doing a state and lake remodel, but there's a $100 million deficit? Yeah. Well, much of that comes from their ability to like do the daily operations, right? Make sure the buses and trains run on time when they do run on time, pay people's salaries, maintenance, gas, things like that. And so the hope is that lawmakers come together and are able to plug this hole. But to Alex's point, my concern is that bringing the number down from $700 to $200 million maybe gives them the wiggle room to focus on more short-term fixes, mm-hmm. when the truth is the prospective deficit for next year balloons back up to $700, yeah. and then the next year to $800. And so lawmakers are saying they want real change, real structural change, but we will see what they ultimately pass. And in the meantime, Metro and CTA have announced that prices are going up.
That's right.
Anywhere from a quarter for a one-way ride on CTA to maybe $1 to $5 for monthly or daily and weekly passes. Then the same thing over at Metra. And so it's really tough when ridership is declining, but most of your budget it relies on the fare box.
Yeah.
And so you're now just going to raise fares on us, which may make us take the train and buses less. Which then keeps this sort of transit death spiral like alive. And so I'm hoping that we get like a real kind of shot at making CTA Metro and PACE more effective and more efficient, but I am concerned if lawmakers can pull that off.
Yeah, and then we'll be back here next year kind of talking about that. Other things that legislators are trying to do in Springfield is limit ICE enforcement in Illinois. And a lot of people have been asking, what can we do? What can the governor do about this? So before the break, we talked about Cook County's top judge banning ICE arrests in county courthouses. Here's Speaker Chris Welsh. He's looking into making this a law statewide.
I do think it's important that we look at legislation that would possibly help statewide. But this process takes the House, the Senate, and the governor's office to agree. We want to look at language. We want to make sure lawyers are all on the same page. If we can do something similar statewide, I'd love to get that done. Because what's happening with these masked ICE agents in courthouses and territories around courthouses is unacceptable. People are afraid to go to court. They're afraid to comply with subpoenas. We can't allow that.
Violet, we are hearing Democratic lawmakers. They're condemning this aggressive immigration arrest. And we've been asking this question, but what power do they actually have to stop it?
Yeah, again, I mean, like we said before, it's super, super limited. And so we're just seeing these ideas kind of find their way up the like chain of command, if you will. You know, obviously we saw this start with Mayor Brandon Johnson, which, you know, declared this through executive order. And then we saw this with the chief judge who put it out through an order, you know, in a very similar manner, as well as Cook County, you know, Board Commissioner Tony Preckwinkle. And so a lot of these have been kind of unilateral actions versus, you know, going to a government body. But that potentially could, you know, make it a little more strong legally. Mm-hmm. You know, we could potentially see that, you know, that might hold up a little better. But again, I think the question remains of like, how is this going to be enforced? And maybe if we see legislation, we will have some of these answers, you know, handed down to us in the text of these bills. But again, that kind of remains to be seen. And so state, local lawmakers, they're grasping at these different things because they can't interfere with ICE agents or any federal agents, you know, legally without getting themselves into hot water.
Yeah.
And even, you know, doing some of the things we've seen legally is Alderperson Jesse Fuentes, you know, asking for a warrant at a hospital when a resident of hers was being detained. And so and she got, you know, briefly detained, handcuffed and almost arrested. And so these politicians are in a really, really weird spot.
Yeah. No actions yet, but we'll keep that in mind. But in Springfield, Alex, lawmakers only have a few more days to get their work done. How the heck are they going to accomplish that?
Maybe they won't. I mean, that's often
that's an option.
That's always an option. Yeah. It's veto sessions are always just a real scramble, and it's only, you know, technically only supposed to be a brief little stint. They go back and just scrub up and clean up a couple of little things that they did in the spring. But we always find that there is a massive appetite from many sectors to tackle a whole bunch of stuff. In this case, I really think especially number one is transit reform. And and transit funding, really, just to echo Jacoby's point, there are really two numbers to watch here. One is $250 million to just keep these services running and treading water through next year. And the other one is $1.5 billion, which is what the state has really identified if we want to step up, integrate reform, and modernize the transit system is what's going to be needed. I am not holding my breath that, especially in the veto session, when they have a higher threshold for passing legislation, that they're going to come up with $1.5 billion. But, of course, there are a whole bunch of other things that are piling up. There's calls for energy reform, and everyone's electricity prices are going up. What are we going to do about that? And there are healthcare cuts and Medicaid cuts from the federal government. What are we going to do about that? And even, you know, there's talk about a bill to prevent the bears from getting excessive tax breaks. And, oh, what are we going to do about hemp and synthetic cannabis regulation? Because that failed last time. And so you just get this huge crush of things. And I'm not going to sit here and, you know, expect that they're going to do any single one of them, except maybe for just like a stopgap, keep the transit agencies running.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think about people really dealing with healthcare, their energy costs, like big, big issues. But then there's also the, you know, potentially some willingness to support the bears getting taxpayer funding. It seems like very low on the list of things that they should do.
Yeah, imagine that.
Jacoby, what do you think?
I think a lot of these issues were pushed into the veto session primarily for that reason, so that this mad scramble can disorganize a lot of our attention. That it you know, how could we expect them to get such big things done in such a small window? Because at this time of the year, we forget, well, they had more time earlier in the year to work through this. Some of these things have been on the table for quite some time. And so some of this does come down to political will. But it also comes down to, you know, sort of the, how do I say it? Some of the limitations that the city and state government are under because of the cuts from federal funding, but also the sort of mismatch between their rhetoric of standing up for Chicagoans, Illinoisans, and the reality that, well, it doesn't seem you all have the, whether it's the organization, the funding, the political will to actually carry some of those things through.
Former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan surrendered himself to authorities. That seems like so long ago. Also, this would have been a huge story if we didn't have a thousand other things to cover. Alex, what were your thoughts on that day actually happening?
It's been a long time coming. I mean, I remember, gosh, this must have been probably 3 or 4 years ago now when we had the press conference with all of the, you know, besuited, stern-faced federal prosecutors coming out with their in their press conference to announce that they had finally taken down the biggest fish of them all.
Yeah.
and indicted Mike Madigan. I mean, this has just been happening in slow motion for years. I mean, for decades. Depending on how you look at it. And yeah, I don't know. I think maybe we're just so inured from this and in the public consciousness. It's like he's been out of power for so long, Mike Madigan, that yes, it's understandable. You know, well, now it's finally time for him to go to prison. Or maybe you think like he hadn't gone to prison after all this time. Wasn't he convicted like more than a year ago? We see also just still his influence in Springfield and a lot of the way that things work, and frankly, like the way sometimes that things don't work. I mean, we hear sometimes people say that they miss having someone who was able to dole out favors in order to just pass legislation and get things done. And now that there is gridlock. It's something that people have those kinds of mixed, complicated memories of.
Yeah. Jacoby, I'm interested to hear like what you think about, you know, what does this do for like Illinois ethics reforms and in politics? I mean, does this do anything?
Former Chicago Inspector General Ferguson once said something to me. He said, "The next bank robber always thinks they're smarter than the last bank robber." And that has sat with me for years now, because regardless of if they take another attempt at ethics reforms, if they get something through, if Chicagoans and Illinoisans know one thing is, you know, corruption is, you know, in some ways, like largely built into the fabric of how Chicago politics are done. I mean, some people would argue to have a city council that has like family members replacing other family members may be sort of the bare minimum of that legacy, but it sort of shows the ways that, you know, sort of aldermanic prerogative and things like this work that like they may seem like, should we be questioning this a little bit more? But then some people are like, well, this is just how things are done. And so, you know, sure, Mike Madigan, this huge iconic figure, will now become the face of corruption. But, you know, he lived out his entire career. And I think some people will be willing to take the risk regardless of what's on the books. And so, I'm not too confident in any form of ethics reform.
And I would just say, as this contentious city council budget process progresses, keep an eye out for transactional politics. It's still very much embedded in the way that a lot of things get done. And it can be defended as like, will you do something for my community and my constituents and I'll get on board with your program. But it is also, you know, can be fertile ground for personal favors and patronage and things like that. So something to always just sort of keep your antenna up for.
Politics be politicking.
It was just time for him to be served up by the system so it could say to itself, look, we're doing something.
There's, you know, a system.
Yeah, it was just time for him to kind of get skewered, but, you know.
Speaking of the system, it is day 17 of the government shutdown after the Senate failed again yesterday to advance a Republican bill to extend government funding. Meanwhile, a Department of Homeland Security video about the shutdown is causing some turbulence, get it, at airports across the country. Violet, you liked that one. Jacoby, have you heard about this video? And, you know, O'Hare and Midway say they're not airing it.
Yes.
What are your thoughts?
The Chicago Department of Aviation, which controls Midway, and O'Hare say simply they will not play this piece of propaganda from Kristi Noem, which tries to saddle the entire government shutdown onto the shoulder of Democrats. They are in line with, you know, airports across the country who say they will not play this, which, again, it goes back to what I said earlier. It is hard to sort of remain vigilant when the people who are trying to sort of tear you down are so incoherent. Their propaganda is so see-through, so fallacious. They're not good public speakers. They don't have good rationale, right? Right. None of those things matter. Don't get distracted from the message they're peddling. And so I do appreciate that, you know, at least these small guardrails to prevent the further spread of this propaganda were sort of upheld. But again, now they're just going to frame the Chicago Department of Aviation as insurrectionists. And so this sort of battle back and forth of narrative control is ongoing.
Yeah, it seems like you stand up and then there's a target on your back, right? I also want to get to something that's going to affect a lot of people here locally. I got a social media ad the other day telling me about, I'm going to get a ticket from the CTA. The CTA buses can now use cameras to ticket cars and bikes parked in the bus lanes. Violet, you were doing some reporting on this. What should we know?
Yeah. From my colleague, Kate Heather, another reporter for the Sun-Times. So we've now entered the 30-day warning period. So we have until November 14th. Everybody's going to be getting, some warnings if they're parking in bike lanes, if they're blocking bus lanes, even sitting in expired meters. And so those fines, once the warning period is over November 14th, so everybody's first offense is a warning, whether you're in this warning period or not. But subsequent violations are going to get pretty pricey, you know, $50 for parking on an expired meter if you're caught by these AI cameras run by Hayden AI, the company the city is working with, up to $250 for parking in a bike lane. Now, this is still a pretty limited project. I mean, this is six buses in the downtown area that are equipped with these license plate reader cameras. So it's not like this is going to be citywide. And again, with this warning period, if you are doing these things, you will be finding out very soon by getting these warnings.
Wow. You know, I do think like it's important. You shouldn't be in the bike lane. It's very dangerous. But sometimes I see official cars on there and I'm like, are they going to get ticketed as well?
They are not.
No. But you would like to see it.
Exactly.
What'd you say, Ev?
I said the city loves to ignore its own rules. It's something that we see a lot.
And as somebody who is not like, the most professional driver on the road,
yeah.
I will say some of the worst violations of Chicago traffic laws I've ever seen are by CPD. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah. They being in bike lanes.
Well, I did get scared, so I'm going to be very conscious not, because my luck, it'll be one of those six buses that catches me. So I will not be doing that. Before we wrap up, I do want to talk about the No Kings protests that are being planned for Chicago and the suburbs tomorrow. What are you guys hearing? Will you be attending? Will you be covering, Jacoby?
I have been hearing that they are likely to be larger. People are clearly pissed off, want to come out. Honestly, one thing I would say is I think, and I don't think it's a controversial take, I think white Americans should be on the forefront of these protests, because the truth is this government's agenda is largely built to serve white Americans, whether you agree with it or not, whether you exist in the margins or not. It's built to largely serve. And we know from there it's sort of white, Christian, heterosexual folks. But, you know, I think, you know, Chicagoans, Illinoisans, you know, white folks need to be on the front lines of these protests because, you know, this government is trying to install a white supremacist agenda, to which, you know, I've been protesting, my family has been protesting in this city for generations.
Yeah. I know, Violet, you'll be off. You won't
yes,
be covering.
Yes, I'm off tomorrow, okay. So I won't be there. I was at the first Snow Kings protest. But to that point, I mean, a lot of the folks we've been seeing get arrested at Broadview have been, you know, mm-hmm. white folks who are throwing themselves at this kind of front line. I think the No Kings is going to be, you know, a kind of interesting thing to watch in contrast to the Broadview protests, in the sense that a lot of folks are getting their first protest experience at Broadview in the face of this, you know, violence from federal agents. And so they are kind of being, you know, thrown to the deep end with this stuff. And so I think the No Kings, we're probably going to see a little less of that.
That's it for the weekly news recap. Many thanks to the Better Government Association's Alex Nitkin, CityCast Chicago's Jacoby Cochran, and Violet Miller of the Sun-Times. Whatever you're up to this weekend, we hope you have a good time.